Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is International Financial Management, FIL 344, for spring semester 2022. Today, exchange rates. Now let me get into this. I'm showing you here some exchange rates. The best way to talk about this is to just dive right in. Now you see what I'm looking at here? Euro to the dollar. Those are indirect quotes. Think about it this way. If I say, give $1 for how many of another currency, that's an indirect quote. If I say, one of the other currency, how many dollars is that? That's a direct quote. Now, oddly, this place, I mean, I've seen it both ways. It is a little bit more, it sounds not intuitive, but it has a little bit more use if we do it the indirect way. The direct way. But I'll explain that in a minute. The direct way, it looks, now the indirect and the direct are just reciprocals of each other. So I can just take that 1.1316 and that should come out to be about, what, 88, 89 cents. So in other words, 1 euro would be about 89 cents on that. Now, if that direct quote, now here's where it's useful to use direct quotes. If, let's say that $1 equals 89, let's say it goes to 1 euro equals 0.91. Well, I'm sorry, $1 equals 0.91 euro. Then the euro has appreciated against the dollar. Try that again. Let's say that, well, I brought these and now I'm not using them. Here. That would be a direct quote. Okay. One of the other currency for how many dollars? Now let's say that by the end of today, we go to that. In that case, the euro has appreciated against the dollar. And that's what we would say. See, if you do it the indirect way, it doesn't sound right. The euro is still appreciating against the dollar, even though you see the number going down. This way, you see the number go up. What we're saying here is that at the beginning of the day, I could buy a euro for 88.5 cents. By the end of the day, I could buy a euro, but it cost me 90.2 cents. So in this case, the euro has appreciated against the dollar. It will cost more of a dollar to get me a euro than it did before. Now, what would be the dynamics of why that happened? The dynamics would be simply that, well, okay, something happened that made Europe a better place to, stronger than the United States. Possibly, European interest rates went up relative to American interest rates. So the price of a euro would be more against the dollar. There are other things that could happen, too. There could be anything. I mean, bad economic news in the United States, but not as bad in Europe, could do it. The Fed, European Central Bank, saying we're going to get really tough on inflation, and the U.S. Federal Reserve says, well, we're going to get kind of tough on it. A lot of this has to do, well, not a lot. It almost all has to do with expectations. All of you, I assume, are in finance, or at least you are trying to get a minor in it or something. Otherwise, why the hell would you take a course like this? This one's a little bit more like work than FIL 240. But you do understand these dynamic principles that have to do with, in finance, we look at the future. Nothing about the past matters. Not a damn thing. Because the past, every piece of information in the past, no matter what it is, what number it is in finance, has already come through. It's already impounded in the current situation, in the current state of the numbers. So the only thing that could be driving exchanges, stock prices, bond prices, whatever, the only thing would be expectations and changes in expectations. That's all that matters. That's all that ever matters. Now we'll come back through this. Political risk is an issue looking forward. Credit risk is an issue looking forward. And also there are other factors that drive this. Let me bring up one thing here. As in any market, if any of you have done any stock trading in your lives, or you've heard my lectures, you do understand the difference between the bid and the ask. That single number, well, this stock is at this price. No, don't lie to me, you fool. There's a bid and an ask for everything out there in finance. There's a bid. That's what you're going to sell at. There's an ask, which is what you will buy at. You remember this. It's like... Don't you repeat this, okay? But I'm going to give a quiz today to the 240 kids, and it'll be on there. I'll try to confuse the hell out of them about which one is which. You buy at the blank, and you sell at the blank. So among my multiple choice answers, bid, ask, ask, bid, eBay, Amazon, Amazon, eBay. Yeah, you buy at the Amazon, you sell at the eBay. But that's not the right answer, though, okay? Boy, well, they be screwed up by that. Okay. Look, you know, and this is what happens in this market. Now, I kind of back and forth around here. I'm trying to get this so that you see more of how international works. It's all there together, and you have to kind of put things in blocks, but still they spill into each other a lot, especially in international finance, because you've got things happening in the international scene that really are not part of domestic. You see, in the domestic scene, there's very likely going to be a war. It could be a cataclysmic war, and this is a region of the world that has brought about a couple of world wars so far in the last 100 years or so. So, but in domestic terms, that's not my problem. You'll be the ones who go over there and fight and die in cold, snowy conditions without good, proper nutrition or granola. But in the international scene, we have to care a lot about what's going on over there. We've got our shipping lane maps showing the positions of what we know, rumors about flights, deployments, forward bases showing up everywhere. It's serious. What does this mean? A war would affect Europe quite a bit. It would affect us somewhat. But if whither goes Europe, that's where the United States goes. Okay, anyway, back to this bid and ask. The bid-ask spread. Now, in 240, I would say, well, matter of fact, let me just do something here. A mother's work is never done. Let's do something. I don't know. AMZM. Just for lack of any greater creativity. Really? AMZN. Okay. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Let's try something that's in a normal range of prices. I mean, MSFT, that'll be better. $2,800, yeah, like I can do. Okay, the bid here is $284.56. So you would sell it, if you had a share of Microsoft you wanted to dump, it would be at $284.56. Now, obviously, these aren't real-time quotes, but about that. And then if you wanted to buy a share of Microsoft, you would buy it at $284.93. Okay. Now, realistically, if I put in a buy order for Microsoft, I'm not going to look at any screen and say, buy it at $284.93. I'm going to cap it at $284.90 or $284.85. Why? Because there might be a bargain out there. You always do that. And then if nothing happens within 5 seconds, you adjust up. Okay, fine, whatever, $284.90. Nothing happens there, you just keep working up. So in the real world, these bid asks are a little fuzzy, and they're certainly not what you would see here. Now, in currency markets, there's a bid and an ask. But when I look at this one, I would say your bid-ask spread here is 37 cents. Is that right? Yeah, 37 cents. God, I'm bad at math anymore. Don't get old. Just let people put you in a home. Yeah. Now, in currency, it is much more likely that they'll give you the bid-ask spread as a percentage. So what they would do is, let's say that we have the bid is 88 and the ask is 90. Couple of things. Old school terminology. The mark is 89. That's what you would say. Okay, mark at 89. And usually I'm kind of paying attention to the mark because that might be where I could get something done. But in this market, what you say is the spread is 90 less 88 over 90. That would be what you would say for the spread. You wouldn't say an absolute number. You'd say a spread. You'd say it as a percentage. And there are obvious reasons, the same ones that are true for anything you say as a percentage. It works better if you... Let me see if I can get a calculator here. Okay. Divided by... Oops. To 2.2%. What's a normal bid-ask spread? You got me, because the bid-ask spread, the spread is a function of a number of factors. Let's reel back here a little bit before I start dragging you too far. We got 2 days here to be a happy family this week, so let's enjoy our time together. Currencies and exchange rates. In a de facto sense, there was, since time immemorial, there was a metal standard. And it might be fluid, it might not be kept in many situations, but you would see a coin from England in the Middle Ages and a coin from France in the Middle Ages. And there would be some kind of an understanding of what the equivalent of each of those was in gold. And I mean, we see evidence of that going back into very early history, the first civilizations in Egypt, Africa, and up in southern Europe and in China. There was definitely, they had exchange international trade. Of course they did. And it was generally based upon some kind of an understanding of a base currency. So any coin would be made out of gold or made out of silver. So there wasn't any question whatsoever that it had intrinsic value. It was metal money. Okay, and then we all understood what that metal was worth. And of course, you had countries trying to over time, there were some hilarious stories back from ancient times. You'll find coins that have a veneer, a finish of gold, and underneath it's some pot metal. and things like that. And of course, they actually paid their scientists to figure out how to tell what was gold and what was not. Famous example of Archimedes sitting in the bathtub and figuring out about how to tell if it's gold or not. But let's take us into the more modern sense, more modern times. Chairs drive me crazy. This was definitely a time of an international gold standard. Currencies were measured against gold, and that was how they were measured against each other, through this gold standard. Now, interestingly, just a quick snapshot of where we are now, the standard is the dollar. In crypto world, there are several currencies vying to become the crypto standard. The one that strikes me as probably having the best chance because it's already being used is one called XLM, if you've ever heard of it. But, I mean, the market is so fluid and there's so many scams and cons and volatility and risk, you don't know. But there was no question that gold was the standard. Each currency in the developed world had an equivalent in gold, in ounces, in usually troy ounces, if you know what I mean by that. Okay, so 1913. The world was freaking falling apart. I mean, Europe was painfully coming into the age after monarchies. You had this idiot asshole, a whole group of them called the Young Hegelians, stirring up revolutionary fervor in Europe. Among them was a particular fellow named Karl Marx, who was stirring up terror everywhere. He kept getting kicked out of countries, one after the other after the other. And of course, that led to the Bolshevik Revolution, and then you had from there monarchies. Of course, you had the Republic. I believe that was about the Third Republic of France, and it was a mess. The problem, of course, that leads you to a war. You can almost, oh yeah, we got a mess, and we're going to have to kill a bunch of idiots and innocent people, and then figure out that maybe we can clean it up and get started again. Unfortunately, what did we get instead? We got Herr Hitler. But anyway, 1913 was about the end of it. Countries were printing money hand over fist. Some were. Some were playing by the rules, because it had been known for a very long time that printing money creates inflation. In fact, we knew it. In a way, I mean, it wasn't expressed, but we knew it back in the Renaissance. You know those ships we find with the gold in them at the bottom of the sea? That was because they put gold in their cheapest ships to send it to other places, because those ships would oftentimes sink. And what that meant was you cut the money supply, because money was denominated in gold. Sort of a little interesting sidelight of history. Yeah, they had a monetary policy. A bunch of people go down with a whole cache of gold, and then, oh, wow, we now have inflation under control. Believe it or not, that was what was done. So we had a knowledge of inflation and its root cause all the way back then. As a matter of fact, there are even hints that reading some of the minor natural philosophers from Greece and Rome, they seem to know that you print money, you're going to create inflation. And one of the ways that you control that is by continuously expanding your empire to spread the liquidity overhang outward, and you can keep it under modest control for centuries. But, you know, that is that. Anyway, Some countries were printing money just hand over fist. Germany was one of them. It got to the point that by the end of World War I, you would see giant piles of coins along the sides of roads because the people would dump out the coins out of the wheelbarrows and then go and buy what they needed to eat with the wheelbarrow. And there were other countries that were behaving themselves. Great Britain was, it has always been, much to their disadvantage in the early 1990s, they tried to follow the rules. They tried to be British, if you will. But anyway, gold standard just couldn't accommodate. You can't say one Deutschmark equals 1 ounce of gold when the Deutschmark, suddenly one Deutschmark becomes 20 Deutschmarks. A gold standard just completely dies right there on the vine when that happens. So all this crying about, let's go back to a gold standard, man. No, you know, we could go back to using leeches to fix illness too, I suppose. I'm sure some of the anti-vaxxers would like that. I would suggest it to them. Anyway, I didn't say that. In this period after World War I, there was trouble all over Europe. I mean, the Bolsheviks were a problem in Russia. They were spreading the communist stuff out. You had these brown shirt thugs following this little dwarf lieutenant who'd been in prison for trying to cause an insurrection named Adolf Hitler. You had other forces, royalists, monarchists, and it was just a mess. Getting anything through a negotiation process, like a currency exchange rate, yeah, good luck with that. There were countries, and this is something that I don't think the book even mentions, but there were countries that had close ethnic ties, and they would coordinate so that they had like almost like a locked exchange rate because they were so culturally similar, language was similar, they had similar ideals and goals. So you did have some pegged currencies that were working with each other very tightly. But overall, it was a mess. And the United States had not come to the point where it was that shining beacon. It was understood that the United States had a great deal of potential. It was understood that eventually it could become the leader of the world. But that wasn't being fulfilled yet in the 1920s, 1930s, especially because of the domestic economic policies in the United States, which were severe by our standards. They would be considered extreme conservative right-wing. And then, of course, that led to some disasters. And then we were no shining beacon at all. Immigrants came here. Sure, it was a great place for jobs and opportunity, but we weren't in any position to lead anyone. And then came World War II. And we were losing. Don't get me wrong. World War II, we were getting our asses kicked in the Pacific Theater. In the Atlantic, we were sending merchant marine ships by the hundreds to Great Britain, and Germany kept sinking the ships with those stupid little wolf packs of submarines of theirs. And we couldn't escort. We didn't have planes that could fly clear across and escort them early on. So we were getting our asses kicked. By about 1943, it was getting so bad that the Republicans, who had been kicked out in 1932 elections, they were just all kicked out, they started winning elections again. And it was because people were sick of the breadlines, they were sick of not hearing any news. There was a momentous kind of, no one knows about it. The journalists in the South, in the Pacific Theater, were, by the censors, forbidden from showing photographs of combat. How bad it was. And Roosevelt himself said, stop bothering the journalists. Let them publish their photographs in Life magazine, in the New York Times, anywhere they want. Let them show what it's like over there. And then let them bitch because they had to cut back to 3 meals a day. A little unknown piece of history. Well, we came roaring back, and by 1944, we were kicking ass. Two separate, globally separate theaters of combat. We were taking down the Japanese Imperial Army and its nightmare across Asia. We were beating back the Nazis, their menace in Europe. And so in 1944, we, the free world, as it were, the free world, and I wrote a note here, I don't say this. Yeah. Well, actually, you know, the funny thing is that when I was teaching in the 1980s, I could have said this and it would have been considered kind of a negative thing. Now we've gone so long that it's kind of neutralized. It's called the Bretton Woods Accord. Bretton Woods. It was an understanding among the free countries of the world that they would essentially peg to the dollar, fixed exchange rate. It wasn't really fixed because there were fluctuations. But the U.S. had so much credibility and had so much economic power that the nations of the free world followed our dollar, a Deutschmark, a French franc, a Spanish franc, a lira, any of those currencies, you knew what the exchange rate was. It was this, and it was going to stay that. Essentially, this was behind this. And I'm giving you a lot of history here because you're scholars. You need to know more than other people because you're going to be their leaders. And you have to help them. You don't need to try to make them understand what your understanding is, but you understand the importance of what I'm teaching you. You're higher now. And get over it if you want to be a common person. You're not. So I have to teach you this because no one has taught you this before. Our system has failed that much. Bretton Woods technically was a metal standard. And this was during my lifetime. You see, a U.S. dollar could be exchanged for silver. It had an exact silver equivalent. You see, the dollars at that time, when I was growing up, when I was a kid, at the top, wait. Oh, yeah, Grand Slam tonight, yeah. Denny's. Pie. I like pie. Dean Winchester liked pie, too. Madam, what does this say at the top? Right there at the very top.
Federal Reserve Note.
Federal Reserve Note. This is a debt instrument. The Federal Reserve lends money to the government. They buy government debt, just like the Chinese and Japanese do. They print money to do it, of course. And then this promises that it's a note, so it's 1 to 7 years in duration, that they will pay this off. Now, how do they pay this off? They print more of them. Do you wish you could do that? You could pay off your debts, just print some more. Here's your damn bill, electric company. Well, this wasn't the way it was. This read at the top, silver certificate. It was exchangeable for pure silver. How? Because the quarters were made of silver. The dimes were silver. So if you just got 4 quarters for this, you got silver. It was a perfect silver exchange rate. And the silver was, of course, backed by the gold. So it was a silver-gold standard. It actually wasn't exactly a gold standard. It was a silver-gold standard. But, of course, that locked our currency, made it muscular as hell. And so every country that locked in with us, their currencies were muscular as hell, too. It was a very, very good system. It worked. But we couldn't stand to have that forever. It got to be a problem. The nations began to have some dissimilarities of interest. Now, don't get me wrong, the entire free world still looked to the United States. We were essentially the sovereign equivalent of God. And there are people to this day who want to have us be that again, or something like that. It won't ever happen again, probably. But the reality was that currency, the countries of the world began to see their interests diverging, their monetary policies diverging, their fiscal policies diverging, each one trying to gain advantage over the others. Well, we won't let any foreign goods into ours. That'll make everyone in our country buy our stuff. The other side of it was, what we'll do is we will deflate our currency, and then our exports will be bought by every other country on earth. All kinds of manner of games were being played. We had agreements, and I'll get to those in a minute here, that were trying to control the trade picture and the exchange rate picture. But for the most part, well, in 1964, we stopped making our coins out of silver. Oh, God, you should have heard it at the time. The apocalypse is upon us. And, of course, you also had this thing. Kennedy had become the president in 61. He was a Catholic, so you had these people who were swearing that the Pope was the Antichrist and he was trying to take over the world, and gold was the only thing that could protect the world from the Antichrist. It was just madness. I mean, these people are amateurs now compared to what was back then. But yeah, we stopped using silver. The reason was this. We'd had a tax cut in the 1950s, and then Eisenhower, who was the president, said, no more of that shit. No, we're not going to do that anymore, and we're not going to spend money on social programs. We're not going to spend money on wars, and we sure as hell aren't going to spend money as a government to build up the military-industrial complex. Now, this guy was a general, and that was his policy. And then Kennedy came in, neoliberal, and he was, you know, let us lean into the future. He was a hero from World War II, and he had all these programs. Hated communists. So he was going to start sending advisors to backwaters around the world where communist insurgents were causing trouble. One of those was this nasty jungle called Vietnam. And then he was also, he said, we are going to put a man on the moon by the end of this decade. And of course, all the rocket scientists said, yeah, sure. You're not kidding. Jack, are you out of your mind? We did it. And we passed civil rights legislation. We got social programs going. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was done after he was killed. His vice president pushed that through. Spending on guns and butter. Johnson, his successor, his vice president, who came in after Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas in November of 63, all these programs, spending money. And taxes were not going up because there had been a tax cut, brought it down from 90% to 70%, the top marginal tax bracket, which by today's standards would be like the end of the world for the conservatives. But here's what happened. You're starting to have to print money. Of course, that creates inflation. You cannot have a gold standard around the world if other countries and us are doing this at different rates, because exchange rates would want to move against each other. But if they're locked, then it creates disequilibrium in international trade. So other countries started bailing out of Bretton Woods, saying FTS. Fancy that scenario. They said, FTS, we're not going to be in Bretton Woods anymore. We held on until 70, technically until 73, but we were about the only country still holding on to Bretton Woods. And then it just, like that, snapped. And we went to full floating exchange rates, full float. And that was a freaking mess. Of course, for us, we were just printing money hand over fist. Because of the OPEC oil embargo, we printed money to get people to stop bitching about the oil gas prices. We kept printing it to try to keep the real interest rate low, but inflation started getting in during Gerald Ford's administration after Nixon. He said whip inflation now, but he didn't have the Fed do anything about it. Jimmy Carter came in and he said it's the moral equivalent of war. You just say no to price increases, but he knew better. And so the Fed cracked down and we got out of it in 79, and Carter was kicked out of office because of the interest rates skyrocketing, because the Fed clamped down the money supply so radically. Okay, so this was the end of general, more or less global agreements. Now, when I say global, I don't mean to be disrespectful of third world countries, but they were not a part of this, and who cared about them? We exploit them. When they get out of hand, we send in CIA to overthrow and put in a right-wing dictatorship. That's how we deal with the third world countries. Nasty as it is, that was what we did. And we were always constantly dealing with the idiots in the Soviet Union doing the same things, playing their games. China wasn't much of a problem back then, but anyway. Now, after Bretton Woods, there was never anything like it again. Until you get to the Group of Seven. And there was more to it back in the day. And like I said, sometimes you'll hear the G8 if we want to include Russia in our deliberations. But that one kind of slipped to the side, and it was gone, the global agreement. And then you had regional agreements. This was a way to have countries try to keep their exchange rates in a band. It wasn't too successful, and it never has been, simply because of the foreign exchange traders. And I'll get to that here, as I said, in a little bit. But there were efforts regionally to create mechanisms. In the 1980s, there was the ERM, the exchange rate mechanism. In some ways, it was the predecessor. It was like a proto-version of the European Union. It was a step toward bringing the countries of Europe, especially Western Europe, together in an understanding of how far their currencies could go away from each other before they jumped in, and everyone else in the ERM got involved and put them back into line with each other. So it was essentially like an exchange rate band between any two currencies. Well, if the Deutschmark goes too far above the pound sterling, or if the French franc goes too far against the Italian lira, they would be brought back in. All of them would come in. Okay, the Deutschmark is too high, so everyone's going to dump Deutschmarks to drive them down and use the money to buy the currency that was getting too weak. It was a nice little thing, and it worked for a few years. And then I brought this up, and I'll bring it up here again just to reinforce it. Then this damn thing happened. The Soviet Union collapsed. What a mess. I mean, great. I mean, no more Soviet Union, no more communists. No more misery in Eastern Europe. But the bad part was that East Germany, which had been under Soviet bloc control, the Berlin Wall fell, and everyone started jumping, West Germans, East Germans, my relatives, I haven't seen you in ages. Damn, now I have to buy you birthday presents. It was quite a thing. The problem was that Germany understood that this was Germany, so they were going to have to fix East Germany, which was a mess. And I've talked about this before, but I'm going to go through it now, carrying it forward to its logical end. It was a mess. And so Germany was going to have to spend billions of Deutschmarks to fix its brother that was bringing in from the cold of the Soviet era. So what does the German government do? It starts borrowing money, borrowing capital, insane amounts, in a very short period of time. Of course, Germany, like anyone else, if a government needs money, it will pay whatever is necessary to get the capital that it needs. So, of course, that drove German interest rates through the roof. And, of course, all the other currencies said, oh, God, no, no, no. You're killing us. You're making our currencies virtually worthless against the Deutschmark. And so the ERM, the participants, the signatories to the agreement, started jumping ship. They started bailing, saying, FTS, no, no, no. Except for one stupid country that believed that an agreement is an agreement. That was Great Britain. Well, no, it's just not cricket to violate an agreement we have with the Germans. And so, of course, as the pound sterling started to collapse, how did the British government support it against the Deutschmark? They started selling their gold reserves, all of it. They sold and sold and sold from the exchequer of the currency to hold the pound sterling up against the Deutschmark. Now, I'm telling you this because this will make it come into your mind in a real way. It was just insane. I mean, what happened was that currency trader, he and his little lackeys said, Great Britain's going to collapse. They're running out of gold. After they have no gold, they got to leave. They got to leave the ERM. So what did he do? He went to the Bank of England and borrowed £150,000 and used it to buy Deutschmarks. And then when Great Britain finally, a few days later, said, we're out, no more gold, we got to leave. Of course, then the pound sterling collapsed and this fellow could go back in and pay off his loans in Deutschmarks to the bank with just a tiny number of Deutschmarks. The Bank of England collapsed because its balance sheet collapsed because that loan had become virtually worthless. And so Great Britain fell into a horrible recession because of it. And they couldn't raise their interest rates to strengthen the currency because they were already in a recession that had become a nightmare. People were going, millions of people out of work, suicides, poverty, divorces, families breaking up, fear that King Cholera was going to come back because of all the poverty. And of course, that guy who did that is still alive now, and he's considered the hero of the world. He contributes to liberal causes. He goes to schools and the children sing his praises. He funds candidates. He's a philanthropist. Does anyone know who that is I'm talking about? Come on. Yeah? Soros. George Soros. The day that they were going to execute the stroke, his assistant came to him and said something to the effect, we can go to the Bank of England and we can work out something to try to stop this nightmare. Or we can just pay off the loan in worthless pound sterling. And Soros famously said, go for the jugular. He didn't even bat an eye. And so he made, in the 1993 currency, $2 billion. And others who were following him made a couple billion more off the catastrophe that happened. England has never recovered. It has never recovered. Great Britain hasn't from that. Okay, there's the ERM. The exchange rate mechanism was one attempt. Now, real forward. There are other currency economic agreements in place around the world. One that almost none of you would know about, I think I mentioned it already, otherwise you probably wouldn't, was the Shanghai Accord. It's an economic agreement that has an exchange rate mechanism in it among China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Belarus, and a couple of others that are, and there are new countries that are now have observer status who are on the verge of being brought in. Among those is a rather big problem called Iran, because it is clear that the Shanghai Accord has a military mutual defense aspect to it. What happened in Kazakhstan 2 weeks ago when there was a revolution against the authoritarian Moscow-supported regime was thwarted when Moscow sent in troops to Kazakhstan under the auspices of the Shanghai Accord. So this is not a joke. It is a very serious, and it is along the lines of Bretton Woods mixed with NATO. That's not a very good thing, because if we decide that we've had enough, or one of our allies, I won't mention which ally, but if one of our allies decides to bomb the hell out of Iran to stop their nuke program, well, if Iran has status in the Shanghai Accord, that means mutual defense. And guess who's going to come back and kick the ass of the country that did the bombing? So this has political implications to it, far beyond the exchange rate mechanism that is whatever. Now, there are other ERMs. One of them is about the best one you could imagine. It's the Eurozone. All of the countries now have a common currency. There's your pegged currencies right there. They're all the same currency. And so that's a very, very good one right there. I mean, it's solid as a rock. And it works. And within those countries, there are no borders as far as the free flow of capital. And that includes labor. It can just go anywhere, and there's no tariffs, no questions asked. You just drive around. I mean, it's so different from when I was in that time. I mean, going across the Berlin Wall for a few days was easy compared to if they thought you were bringing goods and services from France into Italy. God, are you carrying wine? No. Yes. Okay, so you got a lot of problems back in the day. They're gone now, just like that. All gone. Free flow of capital is the ultimate in free trade, and it is the ultimate in efficiency of an international system of finance. And they've got it. That makes them an 800-pound gorilla against the United States. The United States has NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, Canada, the United States, and Mexico. It is not a Eurozone because there are barriers to trade. For one thing, we control the flow of labor capital from Mexico into the United States. We control the flow of certain goods from Canada into the United States. We impose standards on these countries with respect to our ideals of safety, health, and all of that. Okay, so there's that. Now, there are some countries that it's like an exchange rate mechanism, except it's a perfect one. They simply denominate in dollars. I teach in Panama in the summers. You can buy anything you want with American dollars. Their currency, the Balboa, is perfectly pegged to the U.S. currency. Perfectly. There are other countries that are in that same situation. The big long-term goal is to get some of these other countries to knock it off with their political instability, to knock it off with their non-transparency, and to get with the rule of law so that I can get them into that same ideal situation where their currency, their economy, is nothing but a baby United States, just like Panama. So when Panama wanted to borrow money, $775 million for a new airport, international airport. Well, the Chinese said, well, you denominated in dollars, and we've got tons of dollars from all these fools who buy our stuff in the United States, and they lent Panama all that money. The Russians are piling in there. The Russians love to turn their rubles into dollars, which is what they do through direct investment in the banks in Panama. The Chinese, same thing. Not the Chinese, the Arabs. They're down there too. You'll borrow money from us and you'll denominate in dollars? Well, sure, we've got lots of dollars from all those people who buy our oil for their gas guzzlers. Oh, but we're going electric. Sure you are. So there are these. And then there is this. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, and I talked about this in the last lecture, GATT is strong. It is a treaty. It is a full treaty among 113 signatory countries. For most of those countries, including the United States, a treaty is the highest law of the land, as specified in the Constitution. So what the GATT agreements, the rounds every 2 years or so, determine? That is the law of our land as far as international trade goes. That's hella good. Any disputes on trade between signatory countries must be adjudicated through GATT at The Hague in the Netherlands. It must be adjudicated there. And I mentioned last time, so for example, Japan had a problem with mad cow disease, otherwise known as bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which creates a condition in humans. If it gets into humans, it's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome. It's essentially your brain turns to sponge, and then you say, go Cubs. Okay. Fortunately, no one heard that. Okay, so anyway, GATT, Japan said, you're not blocking our beef into the United States because of this disease. You're blocking it to protect your local, American cattle producers. And so you see, sometimes a health and safety measure can be used as a trade barrier. Japan accused us of throwing up a trade barrier and calling it a health and safety thing. And of course, it went to The Hague for adjudication, and The Hague laid it out. Look, we'll set up a standard. You're testing your beef by international standards, and when you've gotten it down so that you have zero spongiform encephalopathy for a year or whatever, then the United States must open its borders back to the beef. Simple problem. It's solved. Everyone kind of bitchy, a year, and the United States, yeah, well, we're going to have mad cow people, moo, running around. No, but everyone got to it. Okay, we agreed to this. This is the law of the land for both countries. GATT is awesome that way. And GATT go through rounds every couple of years. They get together. And unfortunately, like I said, they had to stop doing these in the open because every country, city that the GATT negotiators went to for their negotiations for a round, these anarchists showed up and literally burned down the city. Rio de Janeiro, they caused billions of dollars of damage because these evil one-worlders were there trying to take over the world with this GATT agreement. Whatever. GATT's good. It's not perfect. Here are the issues that are involved. First things first. How do you tell the difference between a legitimate health and safety standard and a health and safety standard that is meant to create a trade barrier? Really. Another problem with it is that there are so many innovations coming about technologically, biotechnologically, that GATT, the negotiators, need experts by the thousands just to plow through the nightmare of new technologies. Europe doesn't want GMOs. The United States, it's like hell you can block us. We have got to do GMOs because this is how we're going to feed the world. We've brought down starvation around the world phenomenally, but you get global change coming in here. We can't use animal husbandry and playing with crops over years to get a nicer breed or variety. We got to get things done in a very new way to stop what's going on with global climate change. Guarantee you that if we play around the old-fashioned ways with corn, in 10 years, these nice lush fields with all this GMO in them, they won't even be able to hold it. And they'll be nothing but desert. So there's that problem that is there. Negotiations with respect to information technology. Negotiations with respect to surveillance. Coordination of law enforcement activities. All of this is on the table, and it's a mess. We've just got to keep going and keep making it more and more complex, and that means more and more rules and regulations. But if we don't do this, then we're back to basically the way we'll solve problems is with wars. And so, I mean, if you're game for that, we can go back there. I've got no problem with it. You just stay behind me, for God's sake, and don't shoot your weapon at my back. Or we can do it the civilized way with general agreement on tariffs and trades and other regional agreements, spreading out, trying to do what we can to keep finance in international financial management. It's much better if we do it this way. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.